Welcome back to the Smarter Destiny podcast, and this time we've got an amazing episode from our archives with Greta Van Riel. She's one of Australia's top young serial entrepreneurs, having built five multi-million dollar startups. Wow, she is a branding expert and legend. And we go into her brands, what she did, how she built up the seed list, how she launched it, and in the case of one of her brands, how she only sold on a few days of the month and didn't sell anything on the other days by design. Wow, that is a very different e-commerce business model and a very intriguing one. She launched her first startup at the age of 22 with just $24 in her bank, and now she is a influencer in her own right with a ton of success under her belt. This one is a episode you need a notepad for, I think, because bombs are dropped throughout. Enjoy.
So it was just the biggest adrenaline rush, dopamine hit, chemical rush I've ever associated or experienced with a brand, and I'm probably sure I ever will, because that launch strategy was just insane. So much fun. Insane.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another special interview. It is the morning here in the UK, and that is because I've got our special guest, Greta Van Riel, live streaming from Australia. I don't know why I pointed that way. I think probably Australia's in that way in my head. Anyway, I'm super excited about this interview. Greta is a bit of a rock star. She's got five multi-million dollar brands under her belt. She is one of the top 30 influencers in Australia, I think, on LinkedIn, one of the most viewed profiles there. She's got a huge Instagram following. She's connected with Founder Magazine, and she's teaching students all about e-commerce in her spare time. If that's not enough, she is an influencer traveling around the world because big brands want to know what she thinks and what her opinion is. She's a fantastic person, and I cannot wait for this interview. Greta, how are you?
Good, thanks. We're on very different time zones today.
We are. What time is it there?
4:54 p.m. So nearly 5 p.m.
And where is there?
There is Melbourne, Australia. And we're in my house at the moment.
Nice. And what a lovely frame. For those of you just listening, you're missing out by not watching the video of this interview, because we have just a lovely movie scene background. It truly is fantastic. And so, Greta, we were chatting off air. You know what's to come. You know the kind of outline of this interview. Obviously, we don't know what we're going to talk about, but we've got to find a logical starting point. And often with some of the entrepreneurs, some of the really special people that we speak about, there's a really good struggle somewhere in the past, potentially when entrepreneur evolved, maybe leveled up from employee to employer. That's often a good one. Is there a logical time in your past where we can kick off this this interview, kick off your story? And if so, when is it, where is it, and what are you doing? Describe it for us.
Yeah, of course. So it'd be in 2012. So I was working full-time as a digital marketing manager at a agency in the city in Melbourne, and they were a traditionally print-based agency that were turning toward digital more so. So I was helping lead that sort of digital transition, and I don't know, it was my first time working in a full-time role, and I didn't necessarily like having people telling me what I should be doing when I was probably an immature 22-year-old and thought that I knew everything that I needed to be doing myself. And so I was working on I had like a list of ideas in a Word doc. And one of them was, I'd been making blends of tea for myself and my friends and then the people around the office. And they were getting really popular just amongst my friends and colleagues. And I was just inundated with orders all the time from them, but I was just making them for free because I found it really difficult to ask friends and colleagues and family for money. So I was like, what is a less awkward way to ask these people for money? And I was like, well, maybe I could just create an online store for the product and then they can just check out and buy, and it, you know, it doesn't have to be an exchange. And so I put up a website. It only took me around a day. I used Shopify to do that. And the next morning, so I posted to Instagram. I created an Instagram account. In those days, creating an Instagram account for your business was just literally changing the handle to your brand name. There was no difference between personal or business accounts. And so I just created an account for Skinny Me Tea. I followed a ton of people and they would follow you back because it was the old days of Instagram. And there were no rate limits or anything like that. So you could follow an unlimited amount of people. So I posted to Instagram, I launched the store and four people bought the tea that night. And they were people that I didn't even know. And I was like, cool, you know, bit of weekend spending money. That's handy. You know, the more our Instagram followers grew, the more our sales grew in return. And I realized that it was something I really did need to focus on. So I had to quit my job. I'd only been there for, I think, like around 3 months, I think. And so I quit my job and everyone was like, oh, Greta, that's such a great job right out of uni. You cannot quit it. And so I just basically didn't tell them and quit anyway. So that was how I got out of that.
So I'm presuming you told your boss you quit, right?
Oh, I told my boss, yeah. He was super supportive.
And so that must have been incredible. So so you were getting all of these orders coming in and also working the 9-to-5 at the same time. How did you manage that?
I accidentally, I guess, stumbled across a pre-sale model because during the week I would take the orders and I'd respond to, you know, the bare minimum of customer service that I could. And then on weekends I would fulfill the orders and I was still mixing and making the tea and packaging it all by hand at that stage. So I would just go and buy the raw ingredients. So the cool part was there was like zero startup capital. I was in a free Shopify plan. I think the only thing I really paid for before I started my business was a domain. So it was like $10 or whatever that is, .com.au, I think it was about 12. So that was basically my startup cost at the time. And Instagram was, you know, a free, really open organic growth platform at the time. And we just started growing from there. And I just, you know, it was really simple. And because I knew so little about business, it was so much more simple. I think people overcomplicate things. And a lot of the time it's just focusing down on just one channel that performs well for you. And Instagram was performing well. And I was just like, well, the more followers we get on Instagram, the more sales we make. So I'll just focus on growing our Instagram followers. So we started to do, back in 2012, we were doing tag to win giveaways. So, you know, those giveaways on Instagram where you tag a friend and you both have to be following the brand to win. We just give away really simple little prize packs. Like two packs of tea, things like that. And 2012, after a couple of months, was I guess that's when I discovered influencer marketing for the first time. And I think so many people have this story where you just stumble across it and you're like, what is this? I didn't read any marketing blogs or know, you know, where to look at, you know, the hot new marketing techniques or channels or anything like that. Just a girl from Tasmania actually bought our tea, and she had, this is 2012 though, but she had 1,000 followers on Instagram, which constituted an influencer at the time. And she posted, and we had our biggest day of sales ever, because, and I hadn't asked her to post either, but she posted just being like, feeling so much more energetic, you know, lost a couple of kilos, like, you know, here's my before and after photo. And I'd been steering a little bit away as well from using before and after photos at that time, and they exploded our growth, and so did influencer marketing. So I was like, every time I saw a new influencer that had over 1,000 followers and fit our demographic, I would just reach straight out to them and be like, hey, do you want to try our tea? So we started growing our influencer strategy from there.
Fantastic. And so where did the name come from, Skinny Me Tea?
Well, I think the concept itself, that was my real kind of aha moment when I suddenly thought of like an actual name for what the product would be, because it was a tea and it was a detox. And so I put those words together and made it a detox. That kind of came first. And then the skinny me tea was just everyone at the office had just been calling it skinny tea. Like, can you give me some more of your skinny tea? Because people kept losing weight from it. It wasn't even meant to be necessarily a weight loss tea to begin with. It was literally just meant to be a detox to kind of reset your system and get you like thinking healthier thoughts and craving healthier foods and whatever else. So really the skinny part just came from the customer feedback. So I don't know, I just thought skinny me tea sounded cute. But I mean, the name itself has been quite, I guess, controversial, or it's quite contrarian at least, because in 2012, there was just very different communications, very different connotations around different words. And skinny had a very different meaning to what people would see that as now. So now people are like, you shouldn't tell me to be skinny. But at the time, it was more like skinny milk, you know, skinny martinis, skinny whatever. Like, it was just what you called things. So, yeah, I guess like there was a bit of a cultural difference at the time.
Well, there's definitely no problem with me. I'd love to be skinny. I just like food too much. So definitely no dramas here.
I love food too.
So how did, let's fast forward a little bit. How did Skinny Me Tea evolve out, and how did you begin to transition onto the next thing, whatever that is?
So we grew really, really quickly. And after 6 months, we were doing $600,000 in revenue a month. And to me, as a 22-year-old that had never seen any money in my life, my parents are social workers. So I didn't grow up with a lot of money. Not that that's important at all. But it's just, you know, I didn't necessarily come from a background that understood that, and definitely not a business background. Like, nobody in my family has really had a business before, like in my immediate family. So I don't know. I just kind of, I was overwhelmed, I guess, by that. And my biggest fear was that it had all happened seemingly kind of overnight, and it was just out of control growing. I didn't even know how to stop it if I wanted to. Sometimes I did want to, and we'd be like, okay, guys, I'm going away on a holiday for like 5 days, so get your orders in now. And scarcity would mean I couldn't even go away, because we'd get like a month's worth of orders in that night, because they'd be like, oh, what do you mean you're going away? I need the tea. Like, so I didn't even realize that that was scarcity at the time. I learned a lot before I started my next business. So I started my next company 2 years later. I guess it was in response to that fear. Like my biggest, like I said, my biggest fear was that it all started overnight. It could come crashing down just as fast. And it took, I guess, until a friend in Hong Kong said to me, I was living in Hong Kong at the time by then, said to me, like, Greta, like today is Thursday. If everything went under tomorrow, which is Friday, what would you be doing on Monday? And I was like, it was just the most instant answer. I was like, starting again. Of course I would. So I think like, the biggest mitigator to fear for me was understanding that everything I was learning was experience. And even if worst came to worst, I would start again, like, if, you know, the following week, or, you know, might take longer depending on what happened. But yeah, so I guess then I guess that made me come to the realization that everything that I was doing was repeatable. So I decided to repeat it. And so I started the Fifth Watches in 2014. At the end of 2014, we launched on December the 5th, 2014. And we'd received the watches on the 3rd of the month. And we're like, oh, let's just wait till the 5th, because, you know, it's an extra couple of days and we are called the 5th. And we didn't even necessarily have our sales model yet, but I'll tell you about that in a sec. So basically, we launched on the 5th of December, which was my co-founder's birthday as well, which was a great birthday. And we sold out of all of our stock in that day. And we're like, so that was over $100,000 revenue in that single day. And we're like, now what? We have because we had a wait list that we'd built up from an Instagram account that we'd built up. So we'd built up a following of 70,000 followers on Instagram before we launched. And out of those 70,000, we'd converted 8,500 around into our wait list for the product. So we were like, oh gosh, like we've sold 1,200 watches, I think it was. We were like, there's like 7,000 people that are going to want to kill us and they're never going to want to buy from our brand again and whatever else. And kind of, I guess, one of my favorite marketing strategies or communication strategies is like thinking about ways to turn negatives into positives or things that seemed accidental into intentional actions. And so I was like, what if we say we're called The Fifth? And little did you know, or little did even we know, that we're called The Fifth because we only sell on the fifth of each month for 5 days or until sold out earlier. And so that became our entire value proposition for our brand. And it meant that we could grow really quite organically because we weren't shoving, I guess, a marketing message or a sales message down our consumers' throat for 25 days of the month. And then there was a really relevant, clear reason to shop at the end of it. And during the month, there was an extremely relevant, clear reason to sign up as well. So it was pretty cool. It became, I guess, yeah, the entire value proposition of the brand.
What an amazing accident.
It was a cool one.
Genius. You couldn't have felt prouder of yourself since, now how am I trying to say this? I bet that was the best idea in your mind. That was the best idea you'd had since you came up with TTOX.
Yeah, no, that was an amazing moment. I remember writing the email. We were sitting there and my co-founder and his brother, who was our first employee actually, was sitting with me and we read it and I read it out and we all got goosebumps. It was just like such a powerful moment. And it was such a fun brand too, because every month was like a new launch. It was like you got to launch the brand again and again and again. But I've exited The Fifth now. I've sold my shares in The Fifth. I started it with my ex-boyfriend. So kind of once we broke up, one of us was probably going to have to move on. And I had a few other things going on by then. And so I was the one to go.
Fair enough. But let's go back. So on the 5th of December 2014, you launched. You'd already built a social Instagram account up to like 70,000. You'd got 8,000 on. Were they pre-orders or is it a wait list or what was
just
that?
A wait list? Yeah, an email wait list.
A wait list, and then you launched on the 5th and sold 1,200 of these watches. So I mean, I feel like we might have missed a couple of steps. So first off, like, why watches, and then what led you into this sort of pre-launch strategy, and what was it that you were really building? Like, 70,000 people who like. What?
Yeah, so I guess the watches was more so my co-founder's passion. He was very much the product-driven person and I was more so the market side. And as I said, we were dating and he'd be running ideas past me and I'd be like, oh, I would do it like this. I'd do that bit like that and I'd do that bit like that. And then it got to, I guess, like a couple of months into that process of like working closely together on the brand and he's like, I feel like you should probably be doing this brand with me, like, you know, you've given me a lot. And I was like, yeah, actually it would be cool to do it. So then we ended up 50-50 shareholders. So it was more so the watch side came a lot more so from him, but yeah, I guess we moved forward from there. When we were building up the page, so basically I say page because we were building more of what I call a vertical account. So just a page within a niche, you know, so like an influencer's page might be someone who's a car driver, a professional car driver, but the vertical page might be at cars or something like that. Okay. So I have a ton of different vertical accounts that I've built up over the years. So I started with Skinny Me Tea. Basically what happened was at the start of 2013, our account got hacked and deleted by like someone, you know, in the Netherlands, but, you know, VPN, wherever. And there was no way to get onto Instagram at all at that time. You could try, but they had zero contact. So we basically just had to be like, you know, okay, let's start over, which was pretty devastating because 200,000 followers at that time would be the equivalent of, gosh, like probably 2 million followers now. Like, I think by the end of 2012, Justin Bieber had like 400,000 followers. So that's the equivalent. We're like half the size of him. So, yeah, it was pretty bad. But again, from, I guess, that negative or that loss or that mistake, I kind of learnt, again, to more so diversify the risk. And so I started to grow up a lot of different accounts in a lot of different spaces. So mostly across like health and fitness and eating and exercise. So combined across all of my different vertical accounts on Instagram, including my personal account and including my brand accounts, I have over 16 million followers across all of those accounts. And so clearly that helped a lot, but a lot of them are in the health space and things like that. So it was like, would someone in the health space want to buy a watch? Like, how do we find, you know, that type of customer? So we were more so giving away, we did some giveaways to kick off the growth of the page. And we were giving away, you know, just related things that we'd be like, yeah, sure. Someone that would wear our watch would wear these Nikes. We'll give them away. Or, and sometimes that really non-targeted approach can be really negative for an account, but watches were just trending so hard in 2014 as well. Almost everyone wanted one anyway, so it didn't really matter that it was a health account or whatever else. And at the end of the day, consumers shop emotionally and then they justify rationally. So if you can find an emotional in or a way to build a relationship with that consumer that's larger than watches, you know, it might be around travel or it might be around time and the concept of enjoying every moment or time well spent, for example, then you can really connect. So I think that we just found some commonalities that people shared and we used those to get interest and start to build a nurturing sort of organic relationship with our customer.
Phenomenal. What an amazing like journey and like such success. And I'm still, my mind is still reeling from the just selling on the 5th. I mean, so amazing. And like you said,
it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was, I like that.
On our first birthday with that business, we did $1 million in revenue in a single day, which was insane. And like around a quarter of that was in the first minute.
So happy birthday.
So it was just the most, it was the biggest adrenaline rush, dopamine hit, whatever you're attaching, the biggest chemical rush I've ever associated or experienced with a brand, and I'm probably sure I ever will, because that launch strategy was just insane. So much fun. Insane.
I absolutely love, I don't know if you would have at that point still kept your like Shopify notifications on, but I absolutely love it when the phone can't cope with how quickly they're coming
explode.
In. It just sort of goes at you as it sort of
and
it goes wrong.
We crashed Shopify because of it. And we were on the phone to Shopify support and they were saying, refresh your screen. We're like, we are refreshing, guys. It's not working. We're not taking any sales. That wasn't on our first birthday, though. That happened a couple of times the months leading up to that. So then it finally didn't happen. And then we finally got to hit that $1 million in a day. And we're like, good, life complete.
Tick. So you exited that business. And so now, you know, you must be feeling pretty confident about your ability to absolutely destroy the internet in a good way with sales. What was the next thing that you like started turning your attention to?
So I guess like the number one way that we'd grown had been through influencer marketing, and we were managing our relationships like every brand was at the time, just, you know, all over the place in email and Instagram, DM, just everywhere, Messenger, WhatsApp, anywhere that influencers wanted to talk to you, just like go and be like, okay, sure, I'll speak to you there. So it was just very decentralized all over the place. And I started to work on kind of an in-house tool so that we could start to manage our own influencer relationships. And then the feature set started growing, and then it's kept growing and kept growing, kept growing. And I was like, to make this viable for us to build in-house, we need to sell it to other brands as well. So that's when I started my influencer marketing platform, which is my main focus right now, growing that. That's called Hey Influencers, like H-E-Y, hello. So basically, it's a bit like a dating app for influencers and brands. So a brand can go on there, they create a campaign, influencers can hey that campaign if they're interested. If a brand is interested as well, they can hey them back. Brands can also search through our database of influencers and hey them themselves if they meet their kind of campaign requirements. And then they can match and chat to collaborate. So I didn't want to create like a basic marketplace or a basic CRM kind of structure for this, because the main thing in influencer marketing and the main thing in basically any marketing is relationship building. And so it was very much about, you know, what's the best tech, what's the best platform that we can build to build longer lasting, better relationships with our influencers on behalf of our brand. And to date, basically, like, marketplaces are all very well for things like cars or things like houses, but they're not so great when it comes to people and relationship building. The best technology that has been built ever, I'm just going to say this century, well, clearly ever, has been the dating app. So that has been the fastest way for people to be able to scale and connect and communicate relationships at an unprecedented rate. So that's why we just designed the platform a lot more like a dating app. So that is a focus of mine at the moment. We're also working on a really, really cool new tool, which is called our scanner, which is coming out in a couple of months. And basically, brands will be able to scan their customer database, their email database, and their social channels and identify influencers above 5,000 followers through that. And it will come up with a sortable list. And if you want to reach out to them at scale and, hey, you know, 1,000, 2,000 influencers at the same time, you can do that through our platform. So that is a bit fun. I'm really excited for that tool. I just build things that I want to use. I'm like, oh, I want to know, you know, we have, you know, 300,000 followers on a brand account, for example. I don't know who, you know, exactly is following us. Like, sometimes you just stumble across someone. You're like, oh, whoever, like, you know, some celebrity is following that page. I had no idea. How cool. So that tool will identify that. But outside of Hey, I have started two other e-com brands as well. So one is called Drop Bottle. So that was my next brand after the fifth that I started. So basically, Drop Bottle, like I was talking about earlier with the vertical Instagram accounts, I've got one called Detox Water. And it was basically like a trend that I saw on Pinterest, just of like, it's so simple, people putting fruit in their water to infuse it. I guess just, you know, to make their water taste better, to infuse vitamins into their water. And make it look better as well. So I started a page on Instagram called Detox Water, and within 4 months, we'd grown that page to 800,000 followers. And so I was like, this trend is like out of control. Like, what is a product that I can create off the back of this audience? So that was interesting, because that was the first time I'd really properly created, like, used, I guess, an audience-driven approach to coming up with a product idea. So, like, audience first, product second, which I guess is flipping traditional models a bit on its head in a way, because, you know, usually, you know, you refer to things like product market fit and you're like, okay, I've got a product. How do I find who to market it to? But at the same time, that is, I guess, the great myth of e-commerce, like the build it and they will come sort of mentality, like, it's build it and they won't come, basically. Like, if you are not working on a community or an audience kind of at least concurrently to building your product, then, you know, you're more than likely not to have the launch that you really want. So I focus on building a strong social community, but ideally, the best thing that you're going to be able to build is your email database. So social is great, but it's more top of the funnel awareness stage, of course. that, but email is much more conversion driven. So,
so what are some of your favorite ways to get your vertical social accounts or handles or however you want to refer them into your email list? Like what's your favorite driver to help them take that step?
Yeah, I mean, incentivization will probably be the biggest one always. Like people need a reason to do something, and that incentive doesn't have to just be something obvious like a giveaway or a discount or a free gift with purchase. That incentive can also be a real need or drive to have to perform that action. So for example, we're only launching this new range, or we're only launching these products exclusively to these people, so get in for that reason. So, you know, exclusivity and scarcity are going to be your two biggest drivers when it comes to converting, well, you know, social or any traffic across into your email subscribers or across to where you want them to go. But again, yeah, giveaways do work very, very well as well. We did this one with the fifth where we gave a watch away a day for 14 days. We use this platform called Gleam, G-L-E-A-M .io. And we collected 80,000 emails off the back of that. And that was basically just converting our social followers over into our email subscribers. So they would earn points for performing certain actions, and signing up to our email database was like the first step in the campaign. So you had to do that to be entered, and then you could perform all different steps. So that was building. I think that a certain extent of your, like a successful competition to convert leads across from social into email. The first step, of course, is getting the email. The next step is getting that competition further and further out there. So most of the steps after we collected their email were just about referring friends, about sharing a tweet, about, you know, sharing a post to Facebook, about sharing, you know, there wasn't even stories at that exact time, about sharing a post to Instagram. So I think like one of the sides, like in any given competition, you want to be getting them to perform the action that you want, but you also want to be like getting them to proliferate that competition as well. So like 50-50.
Fantastic. And so you've got Hey Influencer, your agency. The start of that journey, was that the end of your e-commerce stores, or did you start?
No. Skin Talks, so the last brand. So Drop Bottle came off the back of Detox Water, That was growing. It was ticking along nicely. Like it was doing quite well. But then Oprah found us through social media and chose us as one of her favorite things for her Christmas campaign, and we were front page of Amazon for a week. So that just exploded the brand. So that's been amazing. The brand's been out of stock for a little bit at the moment, but that has been because of a trademark dispute, the drop on our bottle, which is a bit of a killer. But we've just redone the lids, basically, of the bottle to not include the drop, because we're not really going to fight you on it. Go for it. They let us sell out of product at least. But yeah, so we did a bit of a redesign, and that'll be back out within a month. So that'll be awesome. I'm really excited. We've collected so many emails while it's been a little stagnant. But Skinny Me Tea, Drop Bottle, and Skin Talks, which is basically we had a really popular tea, which is our complexion tea, and we wanted to create skincare products that, like, the complexion tea was helping people, I guess, you know, glow from the inside out, and we wanted to do the outside in as well. So we created a range of products that help your skin detox through topical application. So they're the brands at the moment. Outside of that, I will be launching a couple of new e-com brands fairly soon. So that should be exciting. And I run an e-commerce course with Founder as well. So that's great. It's always awesome to come. That's how I met, you know, Brandon and Justin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I met those guys through that course because they won our kind of I guess you know how Shopify has like a builder business competition. They won our version of that through the founder course. So that's how I got to connect with those guys. And yes, yeah, so I've met some incredible people through teaching that course. And I think we've had nearly 6,000 students go through the course now, which has been amazing. It has been seriously one of the most rewarding things that I've done, because it's incredible just watching people build brands. I just sit in the group sometimes and I'm in awe of what people are building. It's incredible. Students have been doing so, so well. So that's been great.
Amazing. Okay, and so part of the reason that we are on this call, the elephant in the room, if you like, is that we've got a event coming up. We are taking off to Koh Samui. I'm going to learn how to pronounce that. Koh Samui, I'll go with that.
Which is it.
A beautiful island off the coast of Thailand. The mastermind of which I co-founded with my business partners, Will, Brandon, who you mentioned, and Daniel. We're holding our fifth event. It's going to be a glorious, luxurious event. We've got the largest villa in Southeast Asia. We've got one member of staff for every two attendees, private beach, hot tubs, something like 28 independent chalets for our attendees, and absolute rock star speakers. And I say speakers, but really it's amazing people that are coming, and joining in the culture, joining in the meals and the sessions and participating. And so as part of the reason we're doing this call today, how are you feeling about the event?
I cannot wait. I was meant to go away this month to Italy to escape the cold of Australia right now, because it's our winter at the moment. And I had to give that a miss, just had a lot of work stuff on, and so did my partner. And so I didn't get my son holiday, and now I am going to, which is so exciting. But I mean, you know, it could be anywhere. It's just such a plus that you guys are somewhere tropical and incredible and amazing, that I would go, you know, to some gross little meeting room in a hotel in the middle of nowhere to meet with minds like the ones that are attending. So I'm just really excited to share as much as I possibly can with people that are there. And I'm also excited to, learn from other people as well. I can't wait to hear everyone's stories. And I think you just form such incredible business relationships and personal relationships when you do things like that. So I guess they're the main things I'm really pumped for.
Oh, yes. And do you have a few perhaps never shared before nuggets that you've got in mind that you're gonna drop just to be like, boom, I'm here, the master's arrived?
Oh, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure there will be. I think just it's good in that climate, because a lot of the time, a lot of what you share is extremely public. So, you know, an interview is going to go onto podcasting. It's going, you know, it's apps. It's going to go onto YouTube. I can share, you know, a lot more of the, I guess, more private things that you're not, you know, necessarily able to share over a format like a podcast or an interview or something like that. Not that I'm, there's not really things that I deliberately don't, but I think it's just that level of detail of being in the same room as someone else. You can go into things step by step and really break them down, because some things require, like, you know, some of your questions I probably could have taken like an hour to answer each. Mm. So I guess it'll just be really breaking down the things that are working, that aren't working, and the things that have been, you know, helping achieve some explosive growth.
Exactly. And yeah, exactly. It's not about withholding things, but it's just about being able to go to that granular level for the whatever the discussion that is taking place in that moment. Naturally, exactly. Big interviews, you have to keep it fairly broad in order to help as many people as as possible. And so exactly what you said, I mean, you know, these events would absolutely work in, you know, a basement room in the bottom of a hotel in
thinking one of those hideous convention rooms where they give you like the gross sandwiches and the coffee from the thing. I'm like, I'd still go to meet you guys.
and sweaty Steve comes up and wants to meet you, that guy. But it would absolutely work in that scenario, but we don't choose to do it in those scenarios. And actually, one of our attendees said it best in January. We were in the Dominican Republic and we leased this incredible palace and it had peacocks roaming and it was beautiful. And one of the attendees said it best. He said that just being in that environment, being masterminding, you know, doing these sessions in a sun-kissed section of the palace, you know, surrounded by you, surrounded, it just forces you to you know, think bigger, it's your mindset shift right off the bat. For him, it was like, I want to own this place and I'm gonna own this place, right? And
definitely an aspirational thing about being an incredible destination.
And of course, you know, and then there's the sun. And do you like Thai food as well?
Yeah, I love Thai food. I've been to Thailand quite a few times. Like, this would be my fourth time, I think, going.
Oh, fantastic. Well,
Make sure, I love Thailand.
Make sure you let our five-star chef know exactly what it is you want. And it'll be incredible. Happy to oblige. So,
Thai at 3 a.m.
Oh, I'll join you on that one. Probably jet lag. I'll be like, lunch. coming from the other side of the world. Do you know? That's not important. That's an off-air kind of thing to
We'll chat about it later.
It's one of those things which I'm not going to bore everybody on the podcast with something so stupid that I was going to say. So. You're going to be hanging out with us and hanging out with the other speakers. By the way, we've got some great other people coming as well. Like, you know, just the attendees, the speakers, absolutely awesome. So, guys, before we move on to the next step of this, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about this particular event, and it's not, in fact, already past mid-September, then check out cartelsmastermind.com. That'll probably be the last time we use that URL with one of our events, so enjoy that as well before we archive it. And should we move on to the quick fire question part of this interview? What do you reckon?
Let's do it.
Okay, cool. What I've started doing, just because I'm a little bit nerdy, is asking my guests to give me two thumbs up for the questions. Are you ready?
Is this it?
There we go.
Am I doing it?
You're doing it. There was a bit of lag and I thought you were rebelling. I thought you were going, no, I'm not rebelling.
I'm too good for the thumbs up. Absolutely not.
All right.
I'm the biggest nerd, so I'm up there with you.
Love that. Okay, so I call it a rapid fire question round. I'm going to ask the questions quickly. You feel free to take as long as you want. And we may go off on a tangent and stuff because...
I'll answer them quick enough.
That's fine.
Well, you're at.
So we're gonna kick off with, are there any unusual things that you eat or drink regularly and why?
I think, I'm Australian and we have this thing in Australia called Vegemite. You guys have Marmite.
We have Marmite.
I think
we
there was just like
have
some
both.
Giant Twitter fight between the two companies or something, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not quite sure about it. I think you can buy both in our supermarkets. I don't think I can really tell the difference. But are you a big fan of Vegemite?
I am, and I have it in the morning quite often, probably like 2 or 3 days a week. I have Vegemite with avocado on toast.
Oh, that's an interesting
quite
combination.
Strange. But I enjoy the saltiness of the Vegemite and then with the avocado. So I guess that's a weird food. People, when I order it at a cafe, they're often like, okay, sure.
You can order things like that, I suppose. That they've got the raw ingredients.
Yeah, I mean, they have Vegemite, they have avocado, they can put them on a piece of toast for me.
Do you have any strong feelings when you go into a restaurant? Say you've got an order like that, and but the person taking the order's got an iPad and they don't have a button for it, and they say, sorry, computer says no. Do you have any feelings about that sort of scenario?
Yeah, no, I guess... I don't think it happens as much. They mostly in Australia in cafes, they just take down the notes. But I hate it when I'm ordering, like, often what I get for breakfast would be like 10 different sides. I'll be like, okay, I want the eggs. I want the halloumi. I want avocado. I want a hash brown. I want this and this and this. And I order like all these sides. And then my boyfriend does the exact same as well. And because we have brekkie together a bit, and they haven't got a pen or paper. And I'm like, you are going to screw it up. I just ordered you. There's like 20 items in your brain right now. And you're trying to sort them between both of us. I'm like, and then I feel like a bitch. If I'm like, could you please just, I think you're just going to need to get a pen and paper out. Because so many times I've wanted to say that, except then they haven't done it and then they've screwed up my whole order. And I'm like, yeah. I told you so.
You're just trying to avoid a future conflict by just suggesting that they write
exactly.
It down.
Exactly. Because I'm not the type to be like, okay, send my food back. I'll be like, okay, I'll just deal with it. And Lucas would like crack it and be like, this is too cold, send it back. So very different in that way.
I like it. But Vegemite and avocado on toast.
Yeah, a bit weird. You should try it.
I'm going to give it a go. Marmite.
Pretty good. Well, Marmite's a bit sweeter, isn't it? Sort of. I don't know. Anyway, we should probably stop talking about Vegemite and Marmite.
Might do a taste test of both. Well, I think this is gold. I think this is, you know, absolutely. People are learning from this, so it's absolutely great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Take notes, guys. Please take notes.
How do you get yourself into a state of flow?
I guess, I don't know. I think pressure just puts me into a state of flow. I'm not the type of person that can just do something if there's no deadline. So a lot of the time, even if I'm just locking something into my calendar to make myself do it in that way, outside of that, the usual sort of things, you know, putting my little, I've got my AirPods in, you know, listening to different playlists, depending, I think, I've learned to be more and more sensitive to what my mood really needs. Like a lot of the time I'm like, okay, I just, you know, I want to be constantly like pumped up and excited. And so, but now I think I'm learning the times where I'm like, I am over pumped up. I'm overexcited. I need to calm down. And so I kind of realize when I need to listen to a more chilled out playlist versus a pump up sort of playlist. Because I think previously I just used to be like, okay, go, go, go. Like, drink coffee, like do this, do this, do this. And it's all just super high energy, high adrenaline sort of things. And yeah, I think now I'm realizing more and more why it's important to have uptime and downtime.
I think that's absolutely well put, like, you know, ups and downs, you know, what goes up must come down and so on. And you know, often like I'll have days where, for example, I'll have what I call modafinil days. Very rare, but modafinil is a really, really great nootropic, and prescribed for something
before.
Completely different.
It does not go well with me.
Well, you have a really productive day, but you need to schedule like the next day to be a little bit eased off. You know,
I say you're borrowing time from your future self, basically.
Exactly. But you know, what goes up must come down, and I like that. And so do you have different playlists in your AirPods? Yay, Apple. For different moods, or
don't screw with me with the Apple reference. I do, just in Spotify. I just have a ton of different playlists for all different types of things, like jazz, classical. Even I grew up around a lot of jazz. My dad is a big fan of jazz, so I love jazz. And then I just, you know, I have just all different, like, I guess that they would obviously be a bit more chilled out. I guess jazz is like mid zone. They can be pretty intense jazz music as well. But outside of that, yeah, just, you know, classic charts, Rap Caviar, the best rap playlist on Spotify. Ooh. I think it's got like 11.5 million followers.
It's really interesting.
I was reading
that.
This article on how it was like a marketing mechanism for Spotify. Like, people literally are so obsessed with this playlist, they're signing up for Spotify accounts just to be able to subscribe to this playlist because it's the only place that it is. And so they're getting people to curate playlists, and now Apple Music are trying to get a couple of other guys to curate this like competing playlist with it. And it's just not quite working out.
That's super interesting. In fact, Daniel, who's one of the co-founders of this mastermind, he actually owns Instagram @rap and has a tremendously successful rap playlist on Spotify as well. But either way, you know, we should definitely be swapping playlists. I've got a few playlists for the ups and the downs and so on. But
okay, perfect. I'll send you some. Some of mine might be a bit embarrassing, though.
I like it. There's definitely some. I think there's definitely some Disney that might have slipped through my net. So that's fine. I'm down with the embarrassment. what habit or opinion do you have that other people tend to disagree with?
Wow. Yeah, that's. I'm not going to be quick fire on that one. I don't know.
It's not like everybody disagrees with it, but some people may disagree with it. Like you feel quite strongly and other people have gone, you know, when they've gone high pitched, like, suggest that they might disagree with it.
I guess it probably happens quite a lot. I just haven't really necessarily taken note or heed.
Just assumed, you know, no, everyone agrees with me. I'm always... It's so this question is designed to eke out something which I mean I'm guessing that you're someone that has a lot of friends, doesn't like I mean just like you said with the waiting staff with all the sides and so on, like you don't necessarily want to step on people's toes, and so it's not necessarily like, oh, you know, you're a firm believer of something horrendous, but like earlier on you said, you know, the myth build it and they will come, I would suggest is an example of something whereby you're going against what the normal belief is. Can you think of anything else that might follow that?
I'm trying to. I just, good question though, because clearly I've never had it before, because I can't think of anything.
Like that.
Nailed it.
Your
mission is complete. I don't really know. I think there's probably quite a few things that I think differently. I'm not necessarily sure. I read something recently that I guess changed my mind about things a little bit when it comes to staff. So it was just a quote that said that you work for your team don't work for you, which I loved. And it's very true. And that kind of hit hard for me recently. But it's not, I think I just, you know, took that from someone else, but I really like that one.
That's fine. I think all of every single thing that we know or believe came from someone else. Like, you know, everything.
Oh,
right?
Of course.
So that's
definitely
that's
what uni teaches you.
Exactly. If you ran a school, well, a really nice segue there, said university. If you ran a school but could only teach one non-traditional lesson, what would that be?
Ooh. Probably community building.
And what would that look like?
I would say, well, I have my three C's of community. And so they are content, collaboration, and consistency. So content is, of course, you know, identifying the types of content that your audience actually responds to and resonates with. Community is not one of the C's of community. I did see that once. I saw someone write like the three C's of community or something, and community was one of them. And I'm like, I feel like community can't be one of the C's, buddy.
Community is the three C's of community.
Three C's of community. Community times three. And then there's collaboration. So, you know, whether that is collaborating with influencers, whether that's collaborating with, you know, other pages in your niche on Instagram, for example, whether it's collaborating brand to brand. I think collaboration is always like the key to growth. And then consistency as well. So understanding that consistency isn't only great for building, I guess, like front of mind positioning through repetition, but it's also on social media a lot of the time, how consistently you post will affect your organic reach. So like the algorithm wants you to be more consistent in your posting. So crash course to my university subject would be the three C's of community.
Nice. I like that. What book or books had the biggest impact on your life?
Definitely Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion. Robert Cialdini. Mm-hmm. Love it. I do not think that I would have started the fifth if I hadn't read that book. And so much of, you know, what I was already doing in marketing just made a lot of sense through reading that. Things like scarcity, exclusivity, likeness. I think he has seven of them I haven't remembered every single one, but
probably influence.
Yeah, the seven eyes of influence. They're all influence.
Nailed it. That's such a great book, and I love it when people make really, really great book suggestions. So I've got to ask, like, have you got maybe two others?
Yes and no. I've read so many. I'm trying to think of one that I have loved. Good to Great is awesome. I read this book. I can't even remember what it was called. I think it was called A Beautiful Question or something like that. That was really, really interesting. That was about the power of the question. And how you can, you know, spark so much more productivity and innovation through being able to ask a well thought out, well structured question. So I really did love, I can't even remember its proper name, except it definitely stuck with me as I'm quoting it now. I love habit forming products for anyone in tech, like how to build a habit forming product. I think that's Nir Eyal. I'm not sure if I just slaughtered his name. I'm sorry. But, yeah, there are a few that just sprung to mind.
Brilliant. Love that.
But influence is just my all-time favourite. So yeah,
that's definitely...
I probably these days I consume more podcast content than necessarily sitting down and reading a book, or I listen to the audiobook version as well. Love Audible.
Nice. Yeah. Absolutely. Do you do that during sort of dead time in the day? Are you multitasking or doing something else?
In the morning when I first wake up, I listen to a podcast straight away because it just kind of gets my brain back into action slowly in like an easy way for me to be able to understand, which is handy. There's two things I usually do when I wake up: listen to a podcast or I set, this sounds psychotic, but I set my, people get repulsed by this, like people that meditate and are all calm when they wake up, I set my first task or to-do list as my alarm title. So whatever that might be, it might be email back this person or do whatever. So I wake up to that notification of my first task for the day, and people are like, that is a horrible way to wake up. I'm like, no, I don't mind.
That's a phenomenal.
I mean, I'm not
going
to set it to be a horrific task, but it's a good way to remember what you need to do.
Yes.
Even I think my one this morning was just, it was really simple. It was just about leaving keys out for the cleaner. Okay. Usually they're more work related, but like, it's just a really good way not to forget whatever you need to be doing in the morning. And I think a lot of people, including myself, like, find it hard to sleep if there's too much going through their mind. So if I'm finding it difficult to sleep, I'll just make like a dot pointed out list of like the things that I'm going to do in the morning and that I can get out of my head right now, do not need to think about because I know they're on a sheet of paper. Probably why I get upset at the waiter for not writing down my order. And it's such a list maker.
Well, I absolutely love how you've sort of done a natural segue into the next question, because the next question is, what does the first 30 to 60 minutes of your day look like, and at what time does it begin?
Great. Begins sometime today, earlier than usual. I was about 6:45 today. I am not a morning person at all. I will happily wake up at close to 8 most days. My office is really close to my house. It's like a less than a 10-minute drive. It's a 3-kilometer walk. Do you guys do kilometers over there?
We've got both. We're a little bit confused in terms of measuring.
Can you translate
distances.
A kilometer into a mile?
I can absolutely
there?
Translate. Yeah, about 3,000 meters. It's all good. It's not very far.
Oh, cool. So often I'll, especially in summer, I walk to the office as well. So I'll walk there and home, and that's when I can listen to podcasts and do things like that as well. Or sometimes I just, you know, I take my first meeting call and I just walk to the office on my call, as long as it's not one I need to take a lot of notes for. So, yeah, I think that's generally what my day looks like. But I think, you know, most days probably closer to the 7:30 mark, but I would find 8 far more ideal. I'm really not the 5 a.m. type. Friends have told me that though.
What does that first 30? Like, we've got overlap here. What does the first 30 to 60 minutes look like? Like, do you have any particular sort of habits or routines or anything that you do in that time? Other than the alarm thing, which I'm stealing the crap out of and definitely doing.
I love the alarm. Yeah. And I give myself quite a bit of time to just like chill out for the first almost hour. Like I said, I'll often just listen to a podcast, and sometimes it's not even a work-related podcast. I love true crime podcasts. Obsessed. Yeah. Addicted. My boyfriend thinks I'm going to murder him in his sleep because I listen to so much murder. I'm like, don't worry, Lucas. It's usually like women and children being murdered. It's fine. He's like, how do you listen to that? You are a female. You're deranged. I'm like, not really. I think I love that. I more so listen to those at night, which sounds creepy, but it switches my brain off because they're interesting enough for me to get into to stop thinking about work-related things.
Yeah. That's interesting. But my cousin, he got married a couple of months ago, and actually, in his wedding speech to his new wife Beth, who's the lady that actually helped us find this particular fantastic villa in Thailand.
Oh, incredible!
He actually said in his speech, as part of his promises to her, that he promises to take her seriously when she's asking him to check under the bed for monsters after she's listened to one of her true crime podcasts.
It's so true. Last night I was convinced a coat looked like a man standing by my door. I was like, why do I do this to myself? But I love it.
Have you got any advice for your previous boss or bosses in general?
Ooh, previous boss or bosses in general. I think what frustrated me the most with, I guess, bosses in general, my previous boss at least, was because it was a corporate company and there was a board, basically my job was always just to make my boss look good. Mm. So I hated that. That was one of the first things I hated when I got into full-time work. I was like, but that's not, you know, that's not going to help do that. I think just not blaming staff or anyone for making a mistake. I think understanding that if you lead a team, that it's your mistake sort of either way, basically. That would be my number one piece of advice. I think also I heard the Warby Parker guys speak. I did this really fun thing called Summit at Sea a few years ago. So it was like what we're doing, but on a boat, and much larger scale, so it wasn't really that intimate sort of mastermind sort of event. But I heard them speak, and they, one of the main things that they say they do, and I think it's in their company vision, is assume positive intent. So it's like whenever you're in an interaction, whenever you're communicating with somebody, assume that they mean whatever they're saying in a positive way. So rather than taking offense, or I think it works in every interaction. So I love that, and I definitely live by that. And also by another quote, George Bernard Shaw said that the biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it's taken place. So if you're not able to communicate and get across and brief a staff member or a team member on what you want them to do, and they come back with something that isn't what you wanted, you know, it was kind of your job to get that out in the first place. So that's another favorite of mine.
Love that. Where do you go, or what do you do to get inspired?
Ooh, I think it's a hard one. I find our customers very inspiring. I do customer service a lot of the time. I know, you know, sometimes you get a crappy email and whatever else, but a lot of the time it is the best way to interact. Like I always say, customer service is the direct intersection between your product and your market. And there's no way that you're probably going to learn more about your brand than just jumping on the customer service emails for a while. So my customers and our customers for our brands definitely inspire me. I'm not one of those, I don't get that inspired. Like if I go to a conference and hear all these people speak, I really don't find that inspiring or motivational personally. I have such an intrinsic or like internalized sense of inspiration or motivation as well. I was a competitive swimmer, and you're just competing against yourself all the time. So I would say when I give myself space to take, I guess, what you'd call like a 1,000-foot view of your business, or a 100-foot view at least of your business, and look down, and rather than being in the micro, get further into the macro. So giving yourself things like strategy days, meeting-free days, things like that. Then I'm far more inspired when I come back again. But mentors for sure as well. I have a great mentor for Hay. His name's Mitch, the founder of Big Commerce. And he's incredible. So Big Commerce is, you know, $1 billion SaaS brand. And he has just been super, super helpful. And we jump on calls monthly, but we message a bit as well. And I'm just always so inspired after that call, because they're very actionable too. I go away and I'm like, okay, like, here are the next 5 things that I'm going to be focusing on for the next month. So yeah, I guess they're the things that get me inspired.
And how did that relationship come to be? I'm always intrigued as to, because there's lots of different stories as to how mentor-mentees become, right? Like how they, yeah, how they start. How did that relationship
start? So he's also Nathan Chan's mentor from Founder. And Founder and I, Nate and I, have Start and Scale, our course, together. And so that's how I was connected to Mitch, through Nathan. And Nathan had had such incredible results working with him, and he came so well recommended. I was like, yeah, sure, sounds great, let's do it.
Fantastic. And is that a free relationship, or do you pay?
It's paid. I think that it's great to pay like for a service like that. Then you have a certain amount of somebody's time. You don't feel like you need to do something back in return either. If it's, I have heaps and heaps and heaps of like mentor-mentee sort of relationships where we both mentor each other basically. Mm. But I think, yeah, I think that when it does come to a mentor like that, it either needs to be paid or in return for something else like equity, for example, because, you know, I don't necessarily have the time whereby I'd rather pay the money than give the time.
Makes sense. If I gave you $5,000, how would you double it in 24 hours?
Ooh, in 24 hours, probably Facebook ads would be the quickest way to double it.
What's the best advice ever given to you?
I would say still the most impactful, powerful advice that I've had was that time in Hong Kong, where honestly my good friend just said to me, like, you know, everything that you fear, like even if everything went under the next day, what would you be doing on Monday? And I was like, starting again. It just seemed, it's such an obvious piece of advice in a way. But at the same time, I think that people do really need to remember and understand that everything they're doing, everything they're learning is an experience. So even if, you know, you do fail or whatever else, you're going to be in such a better position to start all over again, because knowledge is the most powerful asset.
Brilliant. What silly thing should people do more of?
Oh, a silly thing people should do more of. I love these questions. They're out of the usual. You ask me a business question, I can literally fire it off just like bang. You ask me a normal human being question like this, and I'm always like, oh. A silly thing people should do more of. I'm not even sure what people should do more of. What's yours? What would you say?
You've deflected it back. This isn't my time, Greta. This is your time. I try and find the funny in absolutely everything. Even really, really sort of traditionally serious environments, I'll look for a joke. Like if I'm at a funeral, I'd be like, oh, what if someone tripped and the coffin fell? Quite dark, but in my head, I'm like, you know, let's make every situation lighter, because it's all about the perception of the situation. It's not, you know, the situation isn't serious or not serious. It's how you're perceiving the situation. So let's perceive it in a different way, in a funnier way, because everyone needs to laugh more. So that's my nailed it that. Answer. What's yours?
Oh, don't. Now all I'm thinking about is your answer, because yeah, I mean, at the same time, like, I don't know, bad things will happen, and it's strange. I would say that I react in a very similar way to that, because, you know, you need to make the light of things like that. Maybe,
Do you dance around, or do you have guilty pleasures, or one of my favourite answers to this question, whilst you think, was from my friend Aaron Crowell. And what he does is he leaves reviews on Google Places. He leaves reviews on things that no one would ever review. So he gave me an example. He reviewed a cemetery, like where you know, people are buried, as a person that was buried 30 years previous. It's like he's talking about, like, how, you know, it's nice and quiet, there's not a lot of people, I've got a good view, I get the sun in the morning. And we at the end of the interview sort of agreed that what we're going to do next is we're going to leave a review for Heathrow Terminal 5, the actual runway, from the perspective of a plane. You know, the concrete was firm, the length was good, you know, I felt safe coming in, that kind of thing, sort of thing, which is completely pointless, completely silly, but we both laughed, right? And that's kind of the point.
I love that. That's incredible. When I used to play, do you remember that game Words with Friends?
Yes.
I used to just make the creepiest, weirdest words up. I mean, they were words, but I'd use some creepy word and then I'd message the person using that word in a sentence and really creep them out. So I don't know. That's not really, I guess, an example.
Can you give me an example of a word? Can you give me one example of maybe a word that would classify or qualify as creepy?
I'm not sure they'd be appropriate. The interview. Okay. Sorry, I suck at these random little life questions. I really don't think I think about my own life very much.
That's absolutely it's absolutely fun and enjoyable anyway, being on the receiving end of that. So that's absolutely 100% fine, and I'm sure you'll go away and go,
I'm going to be messaging you later. I'm like, oh, yeah, here.
Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Ooh. Like 100 duck-sized horses.
Why?
I just feel like they'd be easier to fend off. Just a horse-sized duck. I couldn't overpower physically a horse-sized duck, but I could several times at least. I just think I would have more of a chance of fighting off the duck-sized horses.
Okay, so this is a sort of flailing arms and legs type scenario, is it, for you?
I say that for myself.
Yes. Okay. How would you convince someone to do something good that they didn't want to do?
Good that they didn't want to do?
Mm.
I think I would probably just justify it to them, make them understand. I don't know. Is this a trick question?
No. Sometimes you have to convince people to do good things and they don't want to do them.
Yeah. I'm not really sure. I think, like, sounds terrible. I'd probably just guilt trip them until they did it.
Make them feel so bad that the thought of doing the thing is less bad than the guilt that's coming from them. That would
totally
work.
I mean, most people want to think that they're kind of virtuous people. There's that whole concept of virtue signaling where people pretend to have certain virtues, like they're like, oh, you know, I'm a vegetarian because I don't want to eat animals, but I will wear leather at the same time. You know, it's just like, it's a bit funny. Mm. So I think that most people under it all will probably want to save face at the end of the day.
I like that. And then final question, Greta, you've been amazing.
Gosh.
Final question. What makes you happiest?
I think nature. I think, like, I just went skiing on the weekend. I like surfing. My boyfriend's really into camping and he drags me along, but I pretend to hate it and I used to cry all the time, actually, and now I actually really love it. I think nature brings out such a childlike energy in people, and I have the most fun, things like skiing and surfing are more adrenaline, but even just, you know, going for a walk in a beautiful forest or something like that, like, they're very mindful moments. So I guess, like, there's mindful, where your mind is like full of crap, and then there's mindful, where you're just taking in your actual surroundings and really being present. So I think being present is what makes me happiest, and nature brings that out in me.
That's a phenomenal answer, which has inspired me to ask one more. Sorry. What would you say?
Better than the, like, what would you do that's silly one, where I'm like, I have no idea. Maybe I'm a very serious person. I don't think I am, though.
What would you say to someone who's considering coming out to our Kosa Mui event and is on the fence?
I'd just say it is like, it's that perfect fusion between a holiday where you're learning at the same time. Like, to me, that's just a no-brainer. I'm like, why would I not go away to like a beautiful tropical destination where I am so looked after? You're going to be waited on hand and foot. You're going to get to experience such incredible things, but with such incredible people, and just expand your network. I guess, like, you know, there's obviously the whole saying, your network's your net worth, but a lot of the, you know, the things that I've done and the opportunities that I've been able to participate in have been because of certain people that I've met along the way. And you just, I guess, you don't know what that missing piece is in the puzzle or in your life until you find it a lot of the time. And, like, I don't think as entrepreneurs or business people or whatever you want to call yourself, like, that we put ourselves in those situations enough necessarily, like, that we really open up to people. You might have surface level networking discussions and whatever else, but I think events like this, you form friendships for life. So it's going to be pretty incredible.
Wow.
Come and be my friend.
Let's do silly things together. I love it. That, what an amazing
friends. What was I thinking?
It was a great answer. It was a real answer.
Yeah, but I will give you a better one when I see you in Kosa Mui.
In Kosa Mui.
Samui. I think. Samui.
Samui. I'm gonna ask Google Translate to tell me, I think. But I trust you, but I want to just hear a robot voice saying it, is what I mean. So, Greta, you've been absolutely phenomenal. Like, genuinely, I've had a lot of fun. This has been a lot of fun. Do you have any asks or requests of the audience?
Come to Thailand. I would say it would be a good one. No, outside of that, I guess just if you're interested in anything social growth or influences, check out Hey, of course. Outside of that, I've just had fun chatting.
Sweet. As have I.
I'll even ask things. I don't know. I'm still a bit funny with that. I still feel funny asking people for things.
And that is a reflection of your generous nature. So I wouldn't feel worried about that at all. Greta, you're an absolute rock star. It's been a pleasure to hear your story, to hear your advice, your wisdom, and all of your answers to your questions. It's clear that you are a very rounded, lovely individual who also absolutely crushes business, sometimes by accident, but it's still the crushing happens. So thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
Hey, Martin here again with an audio goodie bag of a bonus before you head off. First up, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please subscribe and follow Smarter Destiny across iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. It really helps spread our message, and you'll get valuable content along the way too. Secondly, if you have an e-commerce business or are thinking of starting one, grab a copy of my new book, 1% Secret, recommended by Kevin Harrington and a host of other elite guys. Even better, it's free. Just help out with the shipping costs. So head to smarterdestiny.com/book to grab your free copy. Thanks so much, and I'll see you on the next episode.